This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Bloodline, a Sigma Force novel by James Rollins, performed by Peter J. Fernandez. Chapter 22. July 2nd, 5:46 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Charleston, South Carolina.
Get somewhere safe, off the street, but stay in public.
The instructions rang in Lisa's head. Agony lanced up her leg with every step down East Bay Street. She tried her best to hide her limp, baking under the late afternoon sun. When Painter had shouted his warning over the phone to get out of her hotel room, she'd not hesitated. She ran 4 miles every morning, did yoga most nights, and her brother, who climbed mountains for a living, had taught her a few mad skills. Panicked and needing her hands free, she had dropped her cell phone, twisted away from the door, and dashed to the balcony. She heard the splintering crash as the door burst open behind her, but she was already moving through the French doors and vaulting over the wrought iron. She caught one hand on the railing and swung around. With her legs dangling free, she lowered herself hand over hand down the second-story balcony ironwork. Once at the bottom, she let go and dropped the rest of the way to the sidewalk. Even wearing sensible shoes, she landed hard enough to jam her left ankle. A glance up showed a masked assailant staring down at her. He raised a pistol, but she dashed forward under the balcony, out of the line of fire. Shouting erupted above, then gun blasts. She ran. There had been no plan except to put distance between her and the hotel. She had a choice of fleeing out into the neighboring waterfront park or into the narrow maze of historic homes with their quaint porches, filigree woodwork, and colorful gardens. She chose the latter, not trusting the open spaces of the park. Plus, tourists and locals crowded the streets, shops, and coffee houses of the area. She instinctively knew to keep to public spaces. It took her another 20 minutes to calm her heart, to let the adrenaline seep from her brain enough for her to think. Still, she kept searching behind her. Not that she knew whose faces to be watching for or how many were searching for her. Anyone could be a threat. With no money, no phone, she didn't know anyone in the strange city to trust. So she reached out to the one person who could help. She borrowed a phone from a patron seated in a patio coffee house and called Painter. She couldn't say who was more relieved to hear the other's voice, but Painter stayed stern, authoritative. He ordered her to get off the street, out of direct sight, fearing her attackers might be closing a net around the district and looking for her. But stay in public. That meant she needed an indoor space, a bar, a restaurant, a hotel lobby. A commotion drew her attention down a cobbled brick alleyway off the main thoroughfare. A clutch of women in handsome gowns and men in tuxedos gathered a short distance away, laughing and hugging their hellos. It appeared a wedding reception or engagement party was underway at a restaurant back there, and from the richness of the attire, from the haughty edge to their genteel Carolina accents, the event had the air of old money. Perfect. She hid her limp, touched her hair to assure herself she was presentable for a restaurant of this caliber. She hoped the affair was in a private room and that she could still get a seat in the main dining room or bar. A small gas lantern flickered above the sign. McCrady's. Reaching the restaurant, she excused herself as she slipped through the partygoers. As she hoped, they were all filing upstairs to a private room. She stepped up to the host's station.
Excuse me, I'm afraid I don't have a reservation, but I was hoping I could still get a table.
The host, a slender man with a soft manner, smiled.
That shouldn't be a problem this early in the evening, if you'll give me a moment.
Lisa stepped away, but she remained standing. She was afraid if she sat down, she'd never get back up again. Her leg throbbed all the way to her knee. To distract herself, she read a small sign about the restaurant, how the building dated back to 1788. Over the centuries, it had served as a warehouse, a tavern, and even a brothel. It stated that George Washington had once attended a grand dinner party here, hopefully not when it was a brothel. Still, with such a pedigree, it was no wonder the upper crust of Charleston chose this place for special events. Laughter and music echoed down from above. Another few stragglers of the party pushed into the lobby. From the amount of lace and piles of coiffed white hair, they were clearly a few of the grand dames of Charleston high society. "If you'll follow me," the host said to Lisa, drawing her attention away, "your table is ready." One of the older women glanced in her direction, eyeing her from the lofty height of her class position, then leaned to another and whispered. Other eyes stared toward her, judging her. Suddenly self-conscious, Lisa smoothed a hand down her St. John dress and stepped away from them, joining the host. He leaned conspiratorially toward her. "It's cotillion season. They're having a small debutante ball upstairs." Lisa glanced up, picturing a party of chiffon and diamonds, the official debut of a young woman to her high society peers. Balls like this functioned in the past as an antiquated dating service, to present an eligible daughter to available bachelors within a select upper circle. Basically, a high society livestock show. "It's a very exclusive affair," the host said as he led her to the table. He raised one eyebrow toward her. "Some grandniece or second cousin of the president." Lisa felt better. Surely no one would dare intrude here. Crossing into the main dining room, she did her best not to hobble. Still, something must have shown in her face, maybe the sheen of her skin, something in her eye. "Are you all right, ma'am?" the host asked as they reached the table, pulling a chair for her.
"I'm fine."
She offered him a smile, but it felt stiff on her face.
"Just a long day of shopping."
"Of course," he said graciously. But his gaze flicked around her a bit, likely noticing her lack of a purse. "Were you expecting someone else?" She checked her watch. Hopefully so. Painter had told her to find a spot and call him. He had a security detail already headed downtown to secure her. She picked up the menu. Hopefully they'd also square her bill. She needed something stiff and a tall glass, no ice.
"I believe my party is running late," Lisa said. "And I'm afraid I've forgotten my cell. Is there a house phone I might use?"
"I'd be happy to bring you one."
"Perfect. Thank you."
She sat back, soaking in the quiet chatter of the early dinner crowd. The restaurant had a colonial charm with its wood-beamed ceiling, oiled plank flooring, exposed brick walls, and a fireplace tall enough to climb into without ducking. The host returned with a cell phone. She passed on a drink order to her waiter, a single malt whiskey.
"McAllen, please. The 60-year-old.
Expensive, but as a doctor, she prescribed it for herself anyway. And this is definitely going on Sigma's tab. She dialed Painter's secure line, not only to inform him about where she had holed up, but she was also anxious to hear any news about Cat. The connection clicked through. "Where are you?" he immediately asked. She told him, including the address. Painter sighed in relief. "The team is 15 minutes out. Stay put."
"I'm not going anywhere."
The waiter arrived with her drink. The whiskey trembled in the crystal as she held it. She took a sip to steady herself, letting the aged liquor evaporate along her tongue, heating all the way down.
"I'm safe here," she said, attempting to reassure both Painter and herself. "I've got a drink, and I'm surrounded by people. the elite of Charleston.
She heard the tinkle of music flowing from the cotillion upstairs.
In fact, there's a party going on here, some distant relatives of President Gant. Then again, you probably can't turn a stone over here in Charleston without finding someone related to that family.
Painter's next words came too fast, choking a bit. Did any of them recognize you?
An amused snort of disbelief escaped her. Of course not. Why would anyone in the president's family?
Are you sure?
The panic frosting his voice passed to her.
She stared up toward the wood beams, hearing the thump of music, the trickle of laughter. She remembered the grand dame's eyes glancing her way, the sudden whispers.
Painter, what's this about?
I want you to get out of there. Right now.
Lisa stared at the expensive drink in her hand. I don't have any way to pay. If I bolt now, I'll cause a commotion, draw more attention to myself. And she wasn't sure she could bolt, not with her ankle. Now that she'd been sitting a few minutes, even shifting her left leg sent shooting stabs of pain all the way to her hip. She lowered her voice. What aren't you telling me? I can barely walk. I need to know what I'm facing.
A short silence stretched. She imagined Painter rubbing a finger along that line between his brows, debating how much to say or calculating his next step. Over the years, that crease had gotten deeper as he sat in the director's office, and all that rubbing wasn't going to make it go away.
Tell me, she said, tired of all the half-truths and secrets.
He finally spoke, talking fast. I haven't told anyone this. Not Cat, not Gray, not anyone at Sigma, not even you. It was just a dangerous suspicion before, but a few minutes ago I got what I believed to be substantial verification.
About what?
About the Guild.
Lisa went cold.
She knew Painter had been concerned that Amanda's plight could be tied to that deadly cartel.
Did he have proof now?
Painter spoke his next words carefully, as if testing them aloud for the first time. I know who is running the Guild.
Who?
It's the President's family.
The shock took an extra moment to break through her. Surely Painter was joking.
Her mind struggled to put all of the pieces together in her head, trying to comprehend how that could be true. She came to only one conclusion.
That's impossible, Lisa said, her voice faint.
That's why I didn't tell anyone. Not until I knew the truth. I'll explain more once you're back in D.C.
His next words hardened with warning. But Lisa, now you understand. I need you out of there, as silently as you can.
Despite her fear, she fought against a stab of anger at him for keeping this secret from her. And not just from her.
What about Kat?
Don't worry about her. Just get out of that restaurant.
Promising to do just that, she snapped the cell phone closed. She looked up toward the ceiling, still struggling to believe. She had to trust Painter was right.
Readying herself, she downed the rest of the whiskey in a single gulp. A waste of such a fine single malt, but she needed the fortification. She pushed gingerly back to her feet, one hand clasped to the back of her chair. There was no hiding her limp any longer. She hobbled back to the host's station.
Ma'am, are you sure you're okay?
No, not in the slightest.
I'm fine, she lied, and lifted the house phone. Reception's bad in there. Is it okay if I step outside to finish my call?
Of course. Let me help you.
No need.
She hurried toward the door and back out onto the street. She took a few steps, but the uneven cobbles proved too challenging. Her hobble became a fall. A man lunged to her aid, his arms caught her.
Thank you, she began to mumble,
then stared up into the face of Dr. Paul Cranston, the head of North Charleston Fertility Clinic. A gun pressed into her side. Another two men came up behind her. The doctor smiled.
Ah, Dr. Cummings, it's high time we finished our previous conversation.
He motioned to the others. Strong fingers clamped onto her upper arms, hard enough to cause bruising, but a little manhandling was the least of her worries. She glanced back up to the bright lights of the second-story window, heard a piano playing. Cranston made a scolding noise.
I can guess what you're thinking, but fear not, you're not that unlucky. That side of the family knows nothing important, except how to spend money and sniff their noses at common folk.
No, we've been following you since the hotel.
I had men positioned outside when you made such a bold escape.
Lisa stared back at him.
We hoped you'd lead us to whomever you're working with, Cranston said, and pulled a pen from his pocket.
It was Kat's surveillance device. They must have found it in the lobby, but clearly they still didn't know who left it.
A shame, he said, and led her away. Looks like we'll have to do this the hard way. But difficult or not, we'll find your partner.
6:16 p.m. The buzzing shears rode past Kat's left ear. Long locks of auburn hair tumbled down, falling past her shoulder and sliding to the floor to join the mound of hair already piled around the chair. Still cotton-mouthed from the sedative, Kat sat on the seat in the center of the circular ward, with only a sheer hospital gown between her and the cold metal. With her wrists cuffed behind her, she had to tolerate the humiliation, and that was surely the goal here, to break her down. The other prisoner, a doe-eyed young woman in her mid-20s, watched from behind the glass door of her cell, offering her silent support. She and Kat were the only ones here. The rest of the cells appeared empty. The facility was clearly running low on raw material. Kat remembered Dr. Marshall mentioning something about a lodge. They're demanding more research subjects. Clearly, that was one of the purposes of this place, to supply human guinea pigs for various projects, collecting women who had no past, no families, who could easily vanish. And likely, this was not the only such facility in the world. She imagined there were many other collection sites hidden around the globe. But to what end? What was going on here? From the corner of her eye, Kat studied the red steel doors and the embossed genetic cross. Something important was happening at this particular clinic, and she knew any answers lay hidden behind those doors. Earlier, Kat had been forced to strip naked in her cell while Dr. Marshall performed a thorough physical, assisted by the orderly, Roy. Afterward, Marshall had vanished with a tray of vacuum tubes full of Kat's blood. She left with a fellow colleague of hers, another female doctor, their heads bent together. Kat's fingers curled into tight fists as Roy sheared the last of her hair away. They might have taken her clothes and most of her dignity, but she bided her time to win it back. All done, Roy said, running a palm along the stubble of her scalp, raising a slimy chill over her entire body. Always like it when you're freshly shaved. Kat whipped her head away. Go to hell. Feisty, he said with a laugh, glancing toward the locked door, likely looking for Dr. Marshall. Clearly, the man spent most of his day being browbeaten and ordered around by the female clinician. He seemed to take pleasure in taking out his frustration on those left to his tender care. His hand reached to the weapon attached to his belt. It wasn't an electric cattle prod like Dr. Marshall's means of punishment, simply an extendable baton. He'd used it on Kat once already, smacking her across her calves when she was too slow in getting undressed. Her skin still stung. Kat had noticed welts on the other inmate's arms and legs. Bastard. Roy snapped his baton off his belt and with an expert flip of his wrist, extended the weapon to its full length, likely compensating for shortcomings elsewhere. There's not going to be any trouble, is there? Roy sneered in her ear. She gritted her teeth and hung her head. That's more like it.
He rested the baton on her shoulders as he leaned down and undid her cuffs.
Stand up. Keep your hands behind you.
She obeyed, her head spinning slightly from the after effects of the drugs. Cold air blew through the slitted back of her hospital gown as she turned to face Roy. She kept her hands behind her. Roy reached the tip of his baton under her chin, forcing her head up.
That's more...
Kat whipped her arm around and grabbed the baton, yanking it toward her. Roy, caught off guard, got pulled closer. She swung her other arm wide, silver flashing in her fist. She drove the knife into his throat, below the larynx, severing the trachea. Roy's eyes stared at her, stunned, gurgling, unable to scream. But she understood his silent question.
How?
She answered him in a hiss.
Because this cat has claws.
Kat twisted the combat dagger hard. Blood sprayed a full yard across the spotless vinyl floor. In seconds, he bled out, and she let his body tumble to the floor. She wiped the blade on his clothes and folded it closed. When Roy had first tossed her into the cell, waiting for the sedatives to wear off before stripping her and taking away her clothes, she had fought through the fog, freed her left shoe, and removed the folded combat dagger concealed in the sole. She left the lockpick hidden in her right shoe. Unfortunately, her cell door didn't offer access to the keyhole outside. As she put her shoe back on, she hid the blade under a fold of the blanket. Later, when they had stripped her, examined her, and poked her full of needles, she waited until she had a moment alone while putting on her hospital gown. Through the opening in the back, she slipped the folded dagger between her buttocks and held it clamped there. Not the most seemly way to conceal a weapon, but sometimes a lady has to do what a lady has to do. Then she had to wait for a time to get Roy alone. She knew she would have only the one chance. Taking advantage of the moment, Kat worked fast and stripped Roy of his keys, electronic pass card, and baton. She rushed to the other cell and unlocked it. The young woman came staggering out, staring at the ruin of Roy's body.
Thank you. My name's Amy.
Come on, Kat said, encouraging her. She hurried across the ward toward the pile of her clothes and quickly pulled on her shorts, blouse, and shoes. She pocketed her dagger and handed the baton to Amy. Amy squeezed the weapon in her fingers and glanced to the exit.
There are armed guards down the hall. I don't know how we'll get past them.
She noticed Kat staring toward the red steel doors on the other side of the ward.
They took my sister through there 2 weeks ago.
Then that's where we're going, Kat said. She wasn't leaving without finding out what was going on here. Amy remained at Kat's side, looking ready to follow her lead.
Grab the keycard, Kat ordered. We're going to find out what happened to your sister.
Amy gave a sharp nod of acknowledgement. Kat used the moment to grab her purse, which had been set aside with the rest of her clothes. She snapped it open and pulled out the surveillance pen she'd activated earlier. She tucked it into her blouse pocket with the camera end poking out. If I don't make it, I want some record of all of this. Together, they sprinted to the other side of the ward. As they reached the doors, Kat took the keycard from Amy and passed it over the electronic reader. A heavy shift of gears rumbled. A red light blinked brightly overhead, likely wired to an alarm at that guard station outside. As secure as this place was, someone knew this vault was opening. How long until they came to investigate? Before her, the heavy doors parted wider, accompanied by a soft sigh of pressurized air. Kat stared inside, as Amy began screaming. 6:18 p.m., Washington, D.C.
Interview everyone at that damned restaurant.
Painter paced the communications nest at Sigma's headquarters, holding his earpiece in place as he directed the security detail in Charleston in the search for Lisa. The team had finally arrived on site. He turned next to one of the analysts seated at a console.
How long on getting that feed from the local street cameras?
5 or 10 minutes.
He turned his back in frustration.
Lisa?
Where did you go?
After ordering her to leave the restaurant, he had expected a return call within minutes, alerting him to her location so his security team could sweep her up. But as time stretched with no word, panic had set in.
Director, another technician said, pointing to a dark monitor, I still can't get anything more from Captain Bryan's pen camera. The one planted in the clinic's reception area. Either it's been discovered or the battery is drained.
Painter nodded, acknowledging the information.
He spoke to the head of the security team. Split off two men. Send them to the fertility clinic. I want a full report on the status there.
Yes, sir.
Also, we finished questioning the restaurant staff. They confirmed a woman matching Dr. Cummings' description had arrived. She ordered a drink, then suddenly, with no provocation, fled the building. The host saw her talking to three men outside, said she left with them. According to his statement, she informed him that she had been expecting guests.
Painter closed his eyes. Lisa had been expecting his team. It made no sense.
Widen the search grid, Painter said. See if anyone saw where they went.
Yes, sir.
Blood pressure pounded in his ears, but he still heard the deep bass of the voice at the door.
Director Crowe. A word.
He turned to find his boss, the head of DARPA, General Metcalf, standing at the threshold. The man wore the same suit as this morning, still looking fresh and expertly creased. The same could not be said of the general's face. He looked worn, his eyes red, his jowls sagging.
Sir, we need to talk.
That statement never ended well. Underscoring the seriousness, Metcalf rarely stepped into Sigma headquarters. He preferred email, faxes, and conference calls. His presence here did not bode well. Painter clenched and unclenched a fist. He didn't have time for interruptions, but he had no choice.
We can use Captain Bryant's office.
He led Metcalf to the windowed space off the communications nest and chased Jason Carter out of Cat's chair. The young analyst was continuing to work on a private project for Painter.
Give us a few minutes, Painter told the kid.
Once alone, he faced Metcalf.
What's this about?
I've been in meetings with the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs. The President made a brief appearance. Painter heard the drums of war beating in time with his heart.
And?
He asked, sensing what was coming.
We're shutting Sigma down.
Painter shook his head. Not in insubordination, just disbelief. He expected a strong negative reaction from the commander-in-chief, but not this, and certainly not this soon.
When? He asked.
Metcalf wore a sorry expression, but his voice never wavered.
You're to cease all operations immediately.
Painter felt sucker-punched.
Sir, I've got agents in the field, many in dangerous situations. Call them back. Turn any of those situations over to local authorities or up the military chain of command.
And if I refuse? If any agents resist?
Any further actions will be considered unsanctioned, disavowed, and criminal charges may be pressed, depending on a case-by-case inquiry.
Painter took a deep breath and stared at the men and women working furiously in the nest beyond the window. From the corner of his eye, he noted the project Jason had been working on. The genealogical map of the Gant family spun slowly there, a spiraling galaxy of power as cold and relentless as any celestial movement. Painter knew the truth in that moment. The Guild had won.
Shut it down,
Metcalf ordered. Pull everyone out of the field. Chapter 23. July 3rd, 2:18 a.m., Gulf Standard Time, off the coast of Dubai. Gray crouched with his team at the edge of the dark golf course, hidden in the shadow of its clubhouse. The moon had set while they crossed the greens, hurrying from one patch of palms to another.
Despite the dark night, the lighted floors of several of the neighboring towers acted as shining beacons, casting a stark illumination across the rolling lawns. According to the pre-mission briefing, most of the island's security patrolled the shorelines and docks, but they couldn't discount a stray guard spotting them. But now they had another problem to address as he lowered the satellite phone. Moments ago, he had checked in with Painter, confirming they'd reached Utopia. And in hindsight, maybe he should never have made that call.
"What's wrong now?" Seishan asked, reading his face.
"We've been ordered to cease all mission objectives and return to the States," Gray told the others. "Apparently, the powers that be in D.C. need a scapegoat for the death of the president's daughter."
"And that would be us," Kowalski mumbled sourly.
"Painter's working on an appeal, but he has to officially instruct us to pull up stakes here."
"But Amanda isn't even dead," Tucker said.
"Why doesn't the director tell the president that?"
Gray had already explained Painter's reasoning back in Somalia, how Amanda's best chance for recovery lay in a surgical strike to hit the enemy while they believed no one was looking for her. Still, this decision sat wrong with him. Gray believed the president's family had a right to know, and now they were all suffering the fallout. Gray also sensed that Painter wasn't telling them everything, that he was holding something close to his chest. But whatever it was, it would have to wait. They had a decision to make. "Maybe Painter will inform the president as part of his appeal process. But what is he going to tell him? We don't know for sure that Amanda is still alive. All we know is that the charred body at the camp was not his daughter. So we have to make a choice, to retreat back to the ghost or to move forward. If we defy these direct orders and aren't successful, we may face criminal charges. And even moving forward, we'll have limited support." Gray stared around the small group. Seishan shrugged.
"I'm already a wanted fugitive. What's one more crime?"
"And I was never an official member of Sigma anyway," Tucker said. "Nothing says Kane and I have to follow those orders." Gray turned to his last teammate. Kowalski sighed.
"My pants are already soaking wet, so what the hell?"
"Then let's figure out where to start our search." Gray gripped his phone and brought up a detailed 3D rendering of the island. He rotated it to show the outline of a cross. "These are the businesses and—" Kowalski sighed.
"My pants are already soaking wet, so what the hell?"
"Then let's figure out where to start our search." Gray gripped his phone and brought up a detailed 3D rendering of the island. He rotated it to show the outline of a cross. "These are the businesses and properties with possible ties to the guild organization."
"Wait," Seishan said. "How does Painter know that?"
Gray glanced up at her, crinkling his brow. In the rush of information, he never thought to ask that question. Seishan must have read that realization in his eyes. She shook her head, silently scolding him for yet another oversight. Gray tightened his fingers on the phone, irritated as much at the mistake as at Seishan catching him.
"Pull it together."
"Go on,"
Seishan said. "If Amanda is on the island, she's likely to be found somewhere within the properties highlighted."
"That's a lot of territory to cover," Tucker said. "That's why we'll start here, the most likely target, and spiral out from it."
Gray pointed to the center of the cross.
"X marks the spot," Kowalski mumbled. "What the hell? We are looking for a pirate's buried treasure."
Gray straightened. "And let's hope it's still there." He lowered his phone and started toward the center of the island, toward the shining central axis upon which this star turned. And it was turning. The tower, not the island. The floors of the spire, each rhomboid in shape and slightly offset from the next, formed a massive corkscrew. But the most amazing aspect of the engineering was that each story rotated independently of the others, creating a dynamic structure powered by wind turbines and solar panels. It was mesmerizing to look at, shifting slowly
melting into new shapes, meant to mimic a shimmering mirage.
Borj Abadi, Tucker said, naming this central hub of Utopia. The Eternal Tower.
The 50-floor skyscraper had been built in only 18 months. Constructed in conjunction with the island's creation, the two projects rising together out of the sea. Gray sensed that if anything were hidden on this island, it would be there, at the heart of the Utopia. There was only one way to find out for sure. He turned to Tucker and Kane. Time to go to work. 2:22 a.m. Tucker led the way, or rather Kane did. The shepherd ran a full block ahead along a deserted avenue that cut down one leg of the star. He heard his partner's panting breath in his left ear and kept one eye on the video feed, watching for any signs of armed guards or the rare resident of Utopia. He and the others stuck as much as possible to the shadows as they headed the quarter mile to their destination. Palms lined both sides of the road and along a center median. Several stretches of trees were still in massive boxes, waiting to be craned into place and planted. The entire island had that same surreal feeling, like a child's model of a city where pieces sat to the side waiting to be fitted and glued into their proper spot. But as they traveled closer to the star's center, the cityscape became less fragmentary. Buildings grew taller, more polished, shining with lights. Evidence of life began to appear, an occasional golf cart or car in an empty parking lot, a tiny grocery store with stocked shelves, a neon sign glowed in the window of a Korean restaurant. Still, Tucker suspected only a skeleton number of people actually populated the island, and most of those were likely connected in some manner to the guild. To Tucker, that terrorist outfit still sounded like something out of a dime store novel. But then again, he had dealings in the past with many different mercenary-for-hire groups, private military companies with equally colorful names. Saber, Titan, Global Enforce. And while he didn't subscribe to conspiracy theories, he knew that the military-industrial complex was rife with corruption and collusion, generating scores of shadowy organizations that merged armed forces, intelligence services, political ambitions, and even scientific ventures. So what was one more? Earlier, Kowalski had pulled him aside and told him what had happened to Pierce's mother and hinted at previous altercations with this organization. So no matter what this new enemy was named, Tucker and the others were trespassing on their home turf, and he intended to watch his step. And that applied to his partner, too.
Slow, he radioed to Kane.
The jumbling view on his phone steadied as the shepherd's lope became a deliberate pace. Turning, Tucker motioned the others behind a parked yellow Hummer. A tow rig behind the truck held a sleek watercraft and offered additional shelter. In another block, the avenue dumped, like the other four spokes of the star, into a central park that surrounded the twisting spire of Borj Abadi. The Eternal Tower rose like a glowing sculpture into the night sky, each floor slowly turning, making it appear as if the entire structure were gently swaying in the wind off the sea. Only the bottom five stories were stationary, encompassing the building's lobby and maintenance levels, including its power station that collected energy generated by the horizontal wind turbines positioned between each floor.
"Shouldn't we be closer?" Gray asked.
No need, Tucker said. That park ahead is full of shadows, with lots of trees and hiding places. Don't want to stumble upon a guard by mistake. Leave this to Kane.
Seishan agreed.
He's right.
Works for me,
Kowalski said, running his fingertips longingly along the sleek side of the yellow jet boat. Outvoted, Gray nodded for Tucker to continue. The man sent Kane forward with a single command.
Go scout!
Kane stalks slowly forward, remaining in shadows. He moves against the breeze flowing from ahead, letting the scents wash over him, catching what he can with his upraised nose.
He smells salt and wet weed from the distant waves and sand. Closer, he is hit by the crisp bite of cut grass, the trickle of sweetness from petals opening to the night. But through it all, a rank undercurrent flows, reeking of sweat and oil and ripeness of body. Men, in hiding. He hunts each scent, drawing in its heady, foul richness. He stays in shadows, behind bushes, along the edges of benches. He tracks each one down until he hears the satisfying whisper in his ear, "Spotted." Then moves on. He creeps deeper, tail low, haunches tense, ears pricked to every tick, tap, and creak. The smell of man fades behind him, carried away by the wind, leaving spaces for new scents. Then he stops. A trickle of thrill stirs his hackles. He tests again, nose higher, taking that odor deep inside, tasting it, recognizing it. He moves again, tracking its trail through the air. It rises from a truck. He knows trucks and rides and hanging his head into hard winds, but now is not that time. He dashes across an open stretch and into the shadows beneath the truck, a darkness reeking of oil and grease. He slips out the other side, twisting, stretching his neck. He circles and paces, making certain, then whines his triumph and points. "Good dog," Tucker radioed back. Pride spiked through him, and a raw affection that ached. They had all watched Kane's hunt, huddled around his phone's tiny screen. His shepherd had spotted four guards stationed out in the grounds. Then he snuck up to a pickup truck parked crookedly in the circular drive, fronting the entrance to Bourge Abadi. "He's found Amanda's scent there," Tucker said. "She's on the island." "Can you get Kane up into the bed of that truck?" Gray asked. "No problem." It was never hard to get Kane to take a ride. He sent the command, "Up in the truck." The dog immediately backed a yard. Then, with a burst of speed, he launched from his haunches and flew over the side and landed in the rear bed, skittering slightly to avoid hitting what lay there. Kane danced around it, sniffing intently. Seishan leaned closer. "Is that an open casket?" Gray pointed out the bits of tape along the edges. "That's how they moved Amanda. No wonder she was never spotted at the airport. They crated her here, likely under diplomatic seals." Kowalski looked over his shoulder. "Yeah, but where is she now?" They all stared up at the 50-story tower, spinning slowly in the night. They all recognized the truth. The hunt was just beginning. But were they already too late? 2:32 a.m. The tiny boy rested on Amanda's bare belly. Quiet now. The furnace of her body, stoked to a fiery dampness by the delivery, kept him warm. A small blanket covered him, but a tiny fist protruded, no smaller than a walnut. Amanda stared, consuming him with her eyes. With her arms bound to the side, she couldn't hold him. That was the worst cruelty. Even giving her this moment with her child was necessity, not compassion. She had read all the baby books. The newborn was placed face down to encourage the draining of any fluid. The skin-to-skin contact encouraged her body to release its own natural oxytocin, to help with the final contractions to push the placenta free. Her body had performed its ageless duty. Spent, exhausted, she tried to stretch this moment for an eternity. "My baby boy," she whispered, tears streaking through the sweat of her heated face, wanting him to hear his mother's voice at least once. She willed all her love, christening him with the name murmured in the night with her husband Mac, his broad hand resting on the bump of her stomach. "My little William." But sadly, the child was not her husband's, at least not genetically. She knew some of the truth, saw the medical records and the terrifying note that sent her fleeing in terror out to the Seychelles. Still, Mac had loved the baby as much as she did. It shone in his face, even after the truth was known.
He loved you so much, William.
New tears flowed, for the family that was never to be. Voices intruded, but she never took her eyes off her child. Petra, make sure you collect at least 5 millimeters of blood from the umbilical cord. We'll need the sample serum typed, in addition to the standard tests. I'll also want to harvest some umbilical stem cells. Amanda listened, realizing the truth. They were already parsing her child into parts. Dr. Blake, the radiant bed is ready, Petra called from the side. I prepared the vitamin K and the eye drops. Did you want to perform the Apgar assessment? No, you can do it. I should pass on word about the delivery as soon as possible. Blake shifted from the foot of the delivery bed to Amanda's side. He reached to scoop up the child.
No, please, Amanda begged. Another minute.
I'm sorry. It's better this way. You did beautifully. She strained forward, a sob breaking out of her hoarse throat.
No!
Ignoring her plea, he lifted William from her belly, taking away his warmth, leaving a hollowness that she knew would never go away. Blake walked her boy toward a tiny bed under harsh lights, and the nurse with cold eyes. Amanda pictured the shining tray of silver dissection tools. Her sobs turned into racking cries. She rocked within the limits of her restraints. Still, she never took her eyes off her boy.
My little William.
2:38 a.m. Dr. Edward Blake stood by his desk, bone-tired and bleary-eyed. A deep-cushioned chair beckoned, but he remained standing. He didn't want to be relaxed. Not during this call.
Yes? Everything went smoothly, he reported.
The genetics continue to remain stable. After we run the baselines, we'll be testing the stability of the helix assembly under various environmental rigors and stresses. That was the purpose behind Petra's macabre work in her lab. To separate out various vital organs, brain, heart, lungs, and others, to keep those tissues alive indefinitely, so that rigorous tests could be performed upon them. Amanda's child was destined for that lab. I believe we have reason to be optimistic about this boy, he finished.
Optimism is irrelevant, the speaker countered,
the voice digitally flattened and tweaked to an arctic severity, though Edward suspected that iciness wasn't all computer-generated.
Only hard facts matter.
He swallowed.
Of course. We'll start generating actionable data within the day.
Tissue samples should be harvested and couriered stateside as soon as possible.
Understood. I received the list. My assistant is already prepping stem and skin cells. We'll have intestinal and alveolar biopsies within the hour, and cortical and spinal sections by day's end. But I do have another question.
Silence encouraged him to continue.
The mother. Was there a final consensus on what to do with her?
Edward could guess the answer. A massive graveyard had been dug into the jungles outside his Somalia camp.
She may still prove to be biologically useful. As of now, we don't know if these results are broadly replicable or if there is something unique about her genetics.
Edward was surprised at the depth of his relief. He pictured Amanda's tender love shining through the sweat and tears, the strength in her eyes when he took her baby away. That blend of toughness and maternal protection must have touched him more than he imagined.
Or maybe I'm simply tired, getting too emotional. Should we confine her here? He asked hoarsely. On Utopia?
No. Our plans require her to be shipped back to the States.
Surprised, Edward absorbed this and ran various scenarios through his head. He had lightly sedated Amanda for the short hop from Somalia
to facilitate her passage through customs. But a trip to the States was a longer journey, with a much higher risk of exposure.
How do you plan on moving?
He was cut off.
She's intended for the Fert Ink Lab.
Edward had to rest a hand on his desk. He'd visited the fertilization and incubation lab only once, and once was enough. He immediately understood what was demanded of him.
We'll expect her prepped and at the Dubai airport by 8 in the morning,
the speaker finished.
Consider it done.
The line went dead before he got out his last word. They didn't need to hear his acquiescence. It was expected. He remained standing for 2 long breaths. The relief he felt at Amanda's reprieve drained away. Better she had gotten a death sentence. He tapped an intercom.
Petra, we'll need the surgical suite readied.
Her tinny response followed.
For what procedure?
He told her, picturing again what he'd witnessed at the fertilization and incubation clinic, that flawless representation of scientific purity where morality held no sway, a world where only methodology and outcome mattered. He felt bile churn in his gut.
Poor Amanda.
Chapter 24. July 2nd, 6:39 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Charleston, South Carolina.
Kat stepped across the threshold.
Amy followed, shadowing behind her, quiet now after her initial cry of shock and dismay. The large steel doors shut behind them, closing on their own with a pop of pressure. Kat knew they didn't have much time until their escape was discovered. With the door sealed, the ambient light remained low, tinged slightly red, reminding Kat of working in a control room of a submarine during her years in Navy intelligence, where the unique lighting preserved night vision. Or maybe the subdued illumination was meant to blunt the horrors residing in here. A long hall stretched ahead, splitting 2 rows of tanks full of pink gelatinous fluid. Thin, translucent drapes that lined the front of the rows failed to hide what rested in those tub-sized steel vessels. Kat stepped to the side and parted one of the curtains.
"Don't!"
Amy moaned, clutching her stolen baton in both hands, but she still followed, clearly needing to stay near Kat, not for protection, merely to remain near a flicker of humanity in such an inhuman lab. Kat had noted the sign hanging above the hallway. Fertilization Incubation Lab. Here lay that purpose-given flesh. A naked woman floated shallowly in semi-viscous fluid, a gelatinous bed to prevent bed sores and to keep tissues moist. Her abdomen swelled with gravid promise, navel protruding, close to parturition. Her breasts hung loosely, never to suckle the life growing within. The patient's head hung over the arched edge of the tub, eyes taped shut, neck arched back, as if waiting for her hair to be shampooed. But there was no hair. The bald scalp shone in the weak light, revealing sutured scars and wired electrodes snaking into the skull. Other tubes violated mouth and nose, all running to a rack of monitoring, ventilating, and liquid feeding equipment.
"What have they done?"
Amy asked in a horrified whisper. Kat stared down the long row at the other women resting in identical tanks, posed in the same frozen posture of torture, all in various states of fetal gestation. She understood what she was seeing. The women here had been reduced to no more than living brainstems, with only one clear function. "They've turned them into mindless human incubators," Kat said, trembling between impotent rage and bone-deep sorrow. She gaped, unblinking, bearing silent witness. "This is where I would have ended up." Amy wore the same mask of revulsion. Kat shied from imagining herself here, unable to balance this monstrous act with the simple wonders and mysteries of her own pregnancies, of carrying those tiny lives inside of her. She staved off the paralysis of horror by remembering her baby's first cries, the suckle of a tiny mouth on a tender nipple, the grip of little fingers, so demanding, so needy. She pictured the other four buildings of the clinic complex, of the levels of research and development performed here, the cutting-edge retrieval and cryopreservation techniques for ova and sperm, the advancements in in vitro fertilization procedures, and the latest innovation in embryo culture and transfer. Many of the greatest reproductive and genetic scientists from around the globe worked here, or had in the past. How many, if any, knew what trickled down from their groundbreaking research, seeping like toxic waste to pool here with poisonous purpose? Kat swung away, knowing she had only half the answers to the mysteries here. She knew where to find the others. "Come on," Kat said, sensing time running short. She returned to the central alleyway between the rows. She had noted glass-enclosed offices at the back and headed there, striding quickly, with Amy in tow. As her mind raced, she considered various exit strategies. There wasn't likely to be a back door out of this lab, not with what this facility was hiding down here. The only escape was back the way they'd come, through those red steel doors and past that gauntlet of armed guards. She searched as she strode to the end of the room for a weapon, for some other means of escape. She wasn't the only one searching. Amy gasped behind her. "Denise!" Without turning,